It's time for Saturday Live with Sian Williams and the Reverend Richard Coles.
Yes, a very good morning and welcome to Saturday Live, celebrating the wisdom that comes with...
...casting house, taking the 139 bus to the National Theatre on London South Bank, which was a great adventure.
The Royal National Theatre, if you please, powerhouse of the dramatic arts. What's the travel connection?
Well, it wasn't a stage show I went for, but an exhibition, Echoes of a Vanished World, which brings together photographs and artefacts belonging to Robin Hanbury Tennyson. And Robin is, I guess you'd call him a very old-school kind of explorer and traveller, that when he's not fighting his way through rainforests or striding out across a desert, he appears very much the dapper gent in a pinstripe suit, and he's always plays down his endeavours and insists that everything's, you know, come to him just through luck. But he is a founder of Survivor International, the organisation which aims to protect indigenous tribes, and he's led very, very many expeditions around the world. And the pictures and objects that he's got on show at the Royal National come from travels in Indonesia, Burma, Brazil, and the Sahara mainly.
What sort of objects, John?
Well, I think Robin comes across in a way as something of a boy's own hero, and appropriately, this does seem to be very much a boy's own collection. There are camel saddlebags and poison arrows, pottery charms, penis sheaths, a throne stool, feather headdresses, and the thing that really grabbed my imagination was a weird thing. It was a bow with bullets, not arrows, and it fires these little clay balls rather than arrows, which was fabulous.
And of course, photographs too.
That's right, yeah. They are mainly from his travels in the 50s and 70s. They're all black and white, and the earliest was taken on his first major journey, which was just after he left university, when he went overland in 1957 in a battered old jeep from the UK to Sri Lanka, or Ceylon as it was then. And I asked him if he'd travelled much before that expedition.
I did travel a lot in Europe as a child with my mother. I've certainly always been running away and showing off, which is what exploration is really all about. But this was serious running away. This was abrogating my responsibilities, coming down from Oxford and saying, I'm off around the world and I may never come back. And I'm setting off in a 100-pound jeep. And then I took off and travelled on little boats and worked my way on around the world.
And you went to Burma from Ceylon. When you look at these, are you thinking of modern Burma as it begins to emerge again from the years of the military dictatorship?
It's very timely. I always swore I wouldn't go back until they got rid of the generals, and it looks as though I may be able to go back quite soon. When I was there in January 1958, and I had it to myself, the generals have mucked it about with golf courses and hotels and tourist buses and lots of people and everything. It ain't like it was when I was so lucky to see it then. And wonderful images like the huge Buddha, Thandogwa Buddha, the biggest one there, that may be the only photograph of it before, in the 1975 earthquake, its head fell off. Now there's just a concrete blockhead there.
One of the places is Angkor in Cambodia, and I've been there to Angkor Wat and Angkor Thom next door, which are amazing places, even as they are now filled with many other tourists. Because particularly Angkor Thom is this extraordinary place with all these huge trees growing out of the temples. What was it like then?
There were lots more trees then, and no people. There was a weekly flight with a DC-3 from Bangkok into Siem Reap, and a few intrepid tourists would fly in, spend a few hours looking around, and then fly out again. I stayed for the whole week until the next one came, alone again in Angkor, with my little tricycle and a driver in the front, pedalling furiously. And there was no hotel. I had to find somewhere to doss down in Siem Reap. Magic.
Do you feel now less of an attraction for those places because so many of us can get there?
No, not at all. I took my family and three boys a few years ago when they were all in their teens, and we had a brilliant time seeing all the palaces, and they're much easier and more accessible now. It's just quite fun to see what they looked like before they were discovered by modern tourism.
Here's something you sent home whilst you were away. It's a letter to your mother, I think.
Yes, a lot of my records came from my fairly religiously kept correspondence with my mother. And this is one that I wrote just after leaving Mandalay. And I say, dearest mummy, I'm writing from a noisy little paddle steamer on which I'm going downstream from Mandalay. I spent a heavenly day wandering around the ruined city in a sleepy old dog cart with a mattress in the back on which I slept. Bagan consists of a vast area of huge pagodas, mostly shaped like flat-topped pyramids and about the same size. Inside are colossal gold Buddhas and frightening little steep stone stairways which lead to the top. All that brings it back. On that little paddle steamer, I was the only passenger, treated with great respect by the crew. I was put in a cage in the front, because they said there were lots of bandits on the way who were likely to overrun the boat. But if I was in a cage, I was quite safe. So they fed me bananas through the bars.
Fantastic.
In the mid-60s, you were travelling through the Sahara, through Niger, Chad and Mali, places which, of course, have hit the headlines just recently, what with the civil conflict in Mali and the horrible hostage crisis in Algeria. You were travelling with the Tuareg people, who have, to some degree or other, been involved in some of the conflict. What were they like to travel with? Are they a volatile, a violent people, did you find?
Absolutely not. The first journey I made was actually in 1962, and if funnily enough, the first place I went to was in Aminas, which I was able to fly to from Algiers. I then persuaded the chief of the Tuareg, very reluctantly, to let me go off up into the mountains with a couple of camels and a couple of Tuareg. Travelling with the Tuareg is the only sensible way. And we had quite an uncomfortable time. We were running out of water. It was the basic thing. And we were very tired because it's very steep, rocky ground. It was sort of stretching the limits a bit. And so there was this wonderful moment when the local chief in his white robes came running like a great white swan across the desert towards me, greeting me and embracing me and saying, "You're all right, you're saved, you're all right now." And these are moments that you never forget. And so I love the Tuareg.
It seems so remote, so utterly remote in the heart of the desert. And yet all that region is now caught up in this international conflict. Do you think that that's an inevitable part of the way the world has been going?
No, I think it's a great mistake. And I think a lot of people are to blame. And I'm not sure that there aren't some Western powers who have been redirecting their interest to that area. The Tuareg themselves have been in conflict ever since independence, and they want some level of independence, but like the Kurds, they're stuck in four different countries and very unlikely to be granted autonomy anywhere. But they were in conflict recently. They were actually at war, with a civil war with the Mali government, and then suddenly the whole thing got taken over by Al-Qaeda and the Islamic fundamentalists and has turned into something quite different, which the Tuareg have disassociated themselves from and are now offering to fight with the Mali government against Al-Qaeda. They are the only people who can get these fundamentalists out. They are our friends, not our enemies.
They were certainly your friends. You have some remarkable artifacts, some beautiful daggers from those early trips. Do you just collect, or do you get given these things?
I was given almost everything here. I mean, this dagger here is actually from Chad, from the Tibesti Mountains, and that's the woman's dagger. The women carry much bigger daggers than the men, and the men carry these lethal little things up their sleeves, which are invisible.
When you brought these home, all these daggers, and there are spears from other parts of the world, did you just walk through customs, or were you hauled off to be quizzed?
In those days, it was much easier. I remember coming through customs with that blowpipe, that Penan blowpipe. It was the most lethal weapon. And I mean, the arrows, the points of, there's no antidote to the poison. I even once, twice, from South America, brought back some little beautiful parakeets, which I was given by an Indian tribe, seven little babies. And they'd sit on my shoulder in the plane and fly up and down the aisle. The world has changed.
These are beautiful gifts. When you travel like that, you must be traveling light. Can you reciprocate the gift in any way?
It's very, very difficult to reciprocate. It's one of the things to worry about. Beads in a lot of societies, good Czechoslovak porcelain beads, are much treasured. And don't try giving anybody plastic. But the way of giving is not trade. You don't say, "Well, that's nice, I'll give you a handful of beads." You give everything away on arrival to the chief. It isn't a deal that you will then be given stuff, but it makes it less difficult not to refuse, if you see what I mean.
There are blowpipes and bows and arrows. You have got some nose flutes as well.
They are quite rare. I think only one tribe, the Nambiquara, as far as I know, make nose flutes like that.
From Brazil?
In Brazil. And I stayed with them, and they were playing them all the time. And you'd suddenly hear a little nose flute striking up, and then you'd hear another one answer.
How magical. Would you be able to play us a little bit?
Of course.
Fantastic. You've entitled the book and the exhibition Echoes of a Vanished World. Things like the Buddha in Burma have gone. But the people, are the people still there? Who've given you these artifacts?
Of course they're there. The Penan in Borneo are still there, but they're not nomadic hunter-gatherers living on wild pig and wild sago. Most people have been settled. And in the process of contact, which is usually a very unsatisfactory affair, they tend to be shamed into giving up a lot of their traditional customs.
From your earliest travels, you became obviously involved with the people you were meeting, and then became more directly involved when you were one of the founding members of Survival. How did that come about?
Well, it came about because terrible things were happening in Brazil. A tribe a year was becoming extinct, and because we realised there was no organisation internationally which represented these sort of people. But Survival has campaigned for over 40 years now to give them the right to keep their land, keep their culture, and not be overrun. And if you give people respect and give them the opportunity to control their own destiny, they will very soon start looking after themselves.
That was Robin Hambury-Tennyson. John, does Robin still take pictures?
No, well, he said that very often now he doesn't take a camera because I think he felt that while he's taking all those shots, which may look great when you get home, he always feels he's missing something else. And I by looking through the viewfinder, and I think that's a view that I can understand. But then again, I'm a rubbish photographer, so I might always say that.
It's so easily done, is it? The kind of major things in our life we lose because we see them through a viewfinder rather than direct.
You agree with that, Sean Hughes, don't you? No.